WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Cheers erupted in Tel Aviv as Hamas released three more Israeli hostages.
Dozens of armed Hamas militants wearing masks and military uniforms paraded three male Israeli hostages at a ceremony in Gaza before handing them over to the Red Cross. The men, ages 34, 52, and 56, looked thin and pale but were able to walk on their own power. Families and supporters watching in Israel cheered and embraced.
That's CBS's Robert Berger in Jerusalem. In return, 183 Palestinians have been released today from Israeli jails. And the BBC's Yolan Nell tells us
talks on a sensitive second stage for the Gaza ceasefire are soon due to start in earnest. And many Israelis and Palestinians worry a full end to the war and the return of remaining hostages won't be agreed.
More setbacks for the Trump administration. A judge today blocked the White House's Department of Government Efficiency from accessing Treasury Department records that contain sensitive information. And CBS's Willie James Inman reports.
And in a separate court filing on Friday, a judge essentially told the White House that there's a temporary hold on the plan to put thousands of USAID workers on administrative leave, setting up a court battle in the days to come.
Meanwhile, the president is heading to the Super Bowl tomorrow. Michael Hecht is the CEO of Greater New Orleans.
The Super Bowl has gone from being just a championship game to being almost like a domestic Davos. And so somehow it feels fitting and appropriate. And I can't say that we're surprised. And frankly, we're thrilled.
A small commuter plane that crashed in western Alaska has been found, and authorities say all 10 people on board have died. Governor Mike Dunleavy says flying is an essential mode of transportation there.
In Alaska, we are the state that flies. We have more pilots per capita. This is how we do things.
It's the deadliest crash in the state in the last 25 years. A lot of coughing and sniffling and sneezing going around. Our Jennifer Kuiper reports flu cases are on the rise in every state.
The last time flu levels were this high was in 2009, and the CDC says the cases are still rising. Dr. Chris Bryant is with Norton Children's Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky.
They're seeing extraordinarily high numbers of kids test positive for flu. It's worrisome.
Jennifer Kuiper, CBS News.
While the flu season has peaked twice this year, this winter's COVID surge has been very mild. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Brittany Merlot with WXCO News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section on the WXCO website at BullFallsRadio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Advocates are hopeful Wisconsin's new Office of Violence Prevention will make a difference, but could its funding be in jeopardy? Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Reggie Moore heads community safety at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He formerly led Milwaukee's Violence Prevention Office during a critical period following a 70% increase in homicides in 2015.
The fact that cities are getting smarter on crime and the impact that these types of interventions can have in addressing violence before it happens, I think is something that people understand that we should be doing.
He says that starts with a public health approach to preventing gun violence. It's that approach, he adds, that contributed to Milwaukee's four-year decline in homicides and non-fatal shootings beginning in 2016, one of the biggest declines in the country at the time. While violence prevention offices are not new, larger investments in them are. Moore says in 2016, when he started leading the Milwaukee office, few existed.
For hundreds of years, the country has taken a criminal justice approach solely to this issue, but understanding the fact that this is also a public health crisis and hearing the governor declare this the year of the kid, I think is timely given the fact that since 2020, gun violence has become the leading cause of death of children.
Governor Evers announced he's directing $10 million to the Office of Violence Prevention. The funds are from the American Rescue Plan Act and will provide grants to school districts, law enforcement agencies, and nonprofits to help reduce gun violence. It's still unclear whether the Trump administration will impact federal funds for programs like these. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Central Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Additional accumulation of snow today, maybe another 4 or 5 inches. We'll see a high near 24 degrees. For tonight, becoming partly cloudy with a low around 1. For Sunday, sunshine with a high near 16. Monday, mostly sunny, a high near 18. Right now, it's 19.
Max Inc. has a super show this weekend. Join us as we welcome The Flavor That Kills, Rob Dees and the Steepwater Band. Plus, we'll talk weather with Rippyology. Saturday and Sunday evening at 6, it's Max Inc. on Civic Media. We are local music.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio WXCO, Wausau's home for Up North News Radio.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm your host for this hour and also the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast on all things government, law and justice related here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. I am honored, I'm delighted that you have chosen to spend some time with me and my terrific producer, Max, as we together with you engage in discussion about those latest breaking news stories in the areas of rule of law. And boy, do we have a lot of that from just this past week, including just in moments before we go on the air on this weekend. We're going to talk all about those. And of course, as we do in every broadcast, inviting you to be a part of that important discussion, you can call in at 855-752-4842. That number once again, 855-752-4842. You can also text in, you can drop comments, questions, inquiries of me also in the Civic Media Dropbox. Be a part of our discussion, be a part of our involvement with you here on Amicus Law Review. Amicus, once again, that's the legal word, the Latin word for friend, sometimes adjoining the phrase amicus curiae, meaning friend of the court. The notion is that we are your friend in terms of providing with information, insight, something you don't otherwise know about what's going on in the area of law, and that is our commission here on our weekend broadcast. Once again, lots to get to. Let me tell you about the syllabus this weekend on Amicus Law Review. It is full of rule of law-related stories and events, and again, some of them breaking days ago, some of them quite literally hours ago as we go on the air here in Radio Park, Racine, but going out to broadcast stations throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond in the United States of America. And yes, indeed, that is the focus of a lot of what's going on in the rule of law this weekend. We're going to be spending some time talking about the authorities, the opportunities, the options that various branches of government have to affect our lives and our livelihoods. And if there is one big takeaway, one big lesson to be culled from our discussion this weekend, it is the role of federal judges, and yes, other judges as well, but especially federal judges, in serving as guardrails, standards, protections of our Constitution, of our laws here in our nation, here in the state of Wisconsin. You may recall well that in late January, right after Donald Trump began his service as our president, we spent a lot of time talking about those various mechanisms already in place by virtue of our Constitution, the laws, the statutes of our land that prohibit any particular branch of government from being overreaching, from doing things that they cannot do. The checks and balances, you know those well from grade school and from high school and from college and other things that you may have been engaged in educationally throughout your life. The checks and balances, the rule of law requires, of course, that there are limitations on all the branches of government. And indeed, we talked at that time about three of those limitations on an executive branch that may choose to go beyond its assigned capacity to do the work of you and me. And indeed, we identified three of those. We identified United States attorneys, these people appointed by a president upon the advice and consent of the Senate, to serve as the local federal law enforcement officers. We identified grand juries, branches of the courts, not the executive branch, branches of the courts, 23 people gathered in every single one of the 93 districts throughout our nation and our territories to decide whether or not particular indictments should be issued, determining probable cause. They're also a check on the executive branch and indeed on the Department of Justice. And then we also talked about the important role of federal judges deciding whether or not various actions violate or do not violate the laws of our nation, including our Constitution. We don't know a lot about what's going on with grand juries right now because, again, under Rule 6 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, those proceedings are not public. They're private. We don't know about the extent to which grand juries have been checking any actions by this Department of Justice when it comes to proposing indictments for political reasons, which is the great concern that is out there. Donald Trump committing, as have others, to going after his political rivals, people with whom he does not see eye to eye. We don't know about that just because, again, grand jury proceedings are private. But we perhaps will know about that down the road if indeed particular targets, their attorneys, particular defendants find themselves on the receiving end of grand jury subpoenas and other proceedings there. We know a little bit more about the United States attorneys, including at least one of them in the District of Columbia, who sure seems to be bent on doing exactly what the president wants him to do. We'll see what the other U.S. attorneys do as they come into office in the weeks and months ahead. But this weekend, especially focusing on the third major guardrail, the third major standard that is out there to ensure that a president, in this case Donald Trump, but any president under any administration, does not run afoul of the Constitution and of the laws and of the administrative procedures, all of those things that are in place by virtue of our electing a Congress that decides what the law is, that tells us what the law is, by virtue of passing legislation. Those pieces of legislation, of course, if they're to become law, have to be signed by a president, but they become the law of the land. And federal judges, and in particular district court judges, in recent weeks and days and even, yes, hours, are responsible now more than ever before for putting the brakes on many, not all, but some of the things that Donald Trump and his administration have been doing, proposing, finding in the context of what are called temporary restraining orders, enjoining the administration from doing various things that it wants to do. This weekend, talking about the role specifically that federal judges have been taking, specifically trial court judges. We haven't seen a lot of this percolate up to the appellate level. And certainly we're concerned as well about the United States Supreme Court. They're also federal judges, justices in their case. And we'll talk a little bit more about the commission given a president to do perhaps exactly the kinds of things that Donald Trump has been doing in these first 20 days or so of his presidency. We're going to go back again as a part of our review, not only talking about federal judges, but the commission given by the United States Supreme Court right before the 4th of July last year, a number of months ago in that major case, that constitution-changing case that gave to presidents not only immunities when it comes to crimes committed in office, as stunning and shocking as that should still sound to all of you, but also talked about the power and the need for a very strong executive branch, needs to act quickly, needs to act decisively, needs to act in greater power, in greater dimension than the other branches of government. I'm going to read to you again during the course of our broadcast this weekend exactly what the Supreme Court has said about that, giving life to much of what Donald Trump and his administration have been doing, telling this president that he can do things that no other president in the history of our nation, 238 years, has been given authority to do. He's been acting on it. And the check, once again, at least in recent days and hours, has been federal judges saying, no, you can't. No, you can't do that. Of course, the jury, as they say, is still out on much of this. Why? Because there are promised appeals of those district court judges' opinions and judgments going up to appeals courts, maybe one day reaching the Supreme Court once again. But right now, once again, judges serving as the guardrails in America. And then we're going to spend some time talking about the other major rule of law event this past week, and that is we have a new attorney general. Her name is Pamela Bondi. She was sworn in on Wednesday of this week. And following up on what we talked about just last week while Pamela Bondi was still going through the confirmation process, you recall well that we talked about these major changes affecting already the Civil Rights Division, shutting down cases, prohibiting the lawyers there from going ahead with consent decrees when it comes to policing in America. We talked about the movement of attorneys outside of the Civil Rights Division into other areas, including sanctuary cities, protections, that is, protections for the government and the Trump administration's view that those sanctuary cities should not be doing what they're doing. We talked about the honors program, the way in which these incoming attorneys had their employment situations canceled as a result of what was going on. We talked about the firing of prosecutors, which have increased even since the time of our last broadcast. Firing prosecutors who were involved with Jack Smith in prosecuting that now dismissed case out of the District of Columbia, charging the now president at that point, also private citizen, but former President Donald Trump for his involvement in January 6th. Also firing the prosecutors in Jack Smith's team who were responsible for prosecuting that documents case coming out of Mar-a-Lago. Since the time of that, promises to fire more prosecutors and indeed promises made good on, as prosecutors involved in the January 6th insurrection rioters have also been given their pink slips in the past week, principally by the U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, who has told them that their services are no longer necessary. And also talking about this major policy inside the Department of Justice, telling U.S. attorneys as they sit in their offices now, as they come into office in the coming weeks, that they should investigate and prosecute local and community law enforcement partners if those partners fail to follow the dictates of the Trump administration when it comes to immigration policy. We talked about all of that last week, and there has been more even in the weeks since that time. We'll talk about Pam Bondi's investiture. We'll talk about the comments that she made that department attorneys serve Donald Trump, not the people of the United States of America. I'll contrast that with Barack Obama and my own experience with him and Eric Holder when I was a United States attorney. We'll talk about her promise to investigate more the prosecutors involved in cases that the president did not like, does not like presently from his past. We'll talk about her establishing some new task forces in the area of religion. We'll talk about her shutting down some things in the area of environmental enforcement and national security. We'll talk about all of those kinds of things. We'll talk about her work to stop the work against Russian oligarchs who are operating in this nation. And we'll talk also about what's going on right now with the FBI, again, at the hands of Emil Beauvais, the deputy attorney general, the acting deputy attorney general, when it comes to special agents also involved in the January 6th investigations. All of that happening just this past week. All of that coming up in our ambitious but achievable agenda here this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
Yamato, the drummers of Japan return to the Grand Theater in Wausau with their Power of Human Strength tour. Experience the explosive energy of these talented musicians when they take the stage on Friday, March 7th. With more than 40 different taiko drums, Yamato engulfs the audience in energetic sound. Yamato. Tickets at grandtheater.org.
You want to feel important. You want to be a part of something bigger, something that matters and can help change things. You want to feel like you belong. We know. We felt that way too. And that's why we did something about it. We aren't just Army National Guard soldiers. We are normal people just like you. And together, we can make a difference. Take on your legacy. Visit NationalGuard.com to find out more.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, home of the Chad Holmes Show.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour. Max and I taking your questions, your inquiries, your comments, your observations at 855-752-4842. Being part of our discussion this weekend here on Amicus, a law review. A big rule of law broadcast this weekend, talking about the executive branch, talking about the Department of Justice, which is a part of the executive branch, talking about the FBI, which is a part of the Department of Justice, talking specifically about judges, the role of federal judges recently in checking Donald Trump on many of the things that have animated these first 20 days with breakneck speed. At the very end of our broadcast, we're going to talk about a district court judge in the District of Columbia, Superior Court of the District of Columbia, something that she did with respect to the Proud Boys, and some engagement with a congregation, a black church there in Washington, D.C., now in charge, believe it or not, of the Proud Boys name and the copyrighted merchandise and other things of its symbols. Now in the responsibility of a black church there in Washington, based upon the work and the decision of a district court, a trial judge in the Superior Court of District of Columbia. I'm going to save that story for the very end, but once again, emphasizing the role of judges when it comes to checking not only government, but also private parties, individuals who may engage in conduct violative of law in that particular case. A judge interceding and making some important decisions after Enrique Tarrio and the Proud Boys vandalized that black church in Washington, D.C. We'll tell you what happened in that particular case. But we're going to begin by doing a little bit of inventory. It's a lot. It's a lot of things going on right now. A bit of inventory just to set the stage for the kinds of things that we have seen over the period of the past 20 days or so. The first 3 weeks of the Trump administration, not all of these are directly rule of law, justice related, but all of them in one way or another, defying legal limits at a minimum, raising questions about the authority of a president to act, and in many cases, simply acting unconstitutionally, as federal judges are beginning to find. All of them probably given strength and given emphasis by a Supreme Court that back in July of last year told all presidents, including this one, that they've got an awful lot of power. Donald Trump exercising that power now in many different ways. Let me give you just a laundry list of the kinds of things that he has done. This first one started arguably even before he began to be the president. You recall well that he ordered the Justice Department, really on his first hours as president, but even before that, not to enforce a ban, a legislative ban on TikTok for 75 days, and to notify the app and its business partners that defying the law is no criminal offense. Well, in fact, that law, established by the Congress, by a bipartisan Congress, finding that there's a privacy concern with TikTok, there's a national security concern with TikTok, a bipartisan Congress passed legislation fairly decisively barring TikTok from operating in the United States unless and until there's a buyer identified, until its Chinese owner sells it, and giving a president some authority to extend that if indeed there is a buyer. I recognize fully that the issue about First Amendment rights when it comes to TikTok is one of those things that reasonable people can disagree on. That's a good thing. We enforce and we observe and we embrace the First Amendment in all things that we do. Nonetheless, the law of this nation was that TikTok going out of business, and indeed it did, you may recall, on January 19th, the president, contrary to the law, regardless of what you think about whether TikTok is a legitimate First Amendment exerciser of rights here in America, Nonetheless, the president directing the Department of Justice not to enforce the law with respect to TikTok. One of the first things he did as the president. The president, virtually on the same day, required blanket temporary freezes on most foreign aid. The longer that lasts, blocking, again, congressionally improved spending. It comes into greater intention with something called the Impoundment Control Act. President can't do those kinds of things after the Congress has spoken and told the president that he, one day perhaps she, is obliged to exercise his responsibilities. Her responsibilities consistent with the law. Did the same thing with respect to a domestic grants freeze. The Office of Management and Budget, OMB, was ordered agencies to carry out a blanket temporary freeze up to $3 trillion, with a cap with a T, $3 trillion in domestic grants and other government spending. The freeze has already been temporarily blocked by two courts after plaintiffs raised challenges to that, including some of the things called the Administrative Procedures Act and, yes, indeed, the First Amendment. So we've got some federal judges stopping that from happening as well. USAID, very much in the news as late as just this past week and, indeed, late in the day on Friday. He moved to dismantle the agency and fold its functions into the State Department, making it under the rubric of Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Again, violation of the USAID constitution, if you will, the legislation establishing it, and structuring that agency as a standalone agency, not subject to the oversight and review of the president. We'll talk more about what a federal judge did late in this past week. Inspectors General. The president summarily fired 17 inspectors general, the watchdog officials who hunt for waste and fraud and abuse in our government agencies. The law says that presidents have to give Congress, once again, 30 days notice and a written substantive rationale, including detailed and case-specific reasons before any removal can be happening here. Violation of the law, once again, Mr. President, when it comes to firing inspectors general. The National Labor Relations Board, this one hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, but he summarily fired a member of the independent agency before her term was up. And it paralyzed the NLRB that does an awful lot with respect to labor in our country, leaving without a quorum. Well, a law says that presidents may only remove board members upon notice and hearing for neglect of duty or malfeasance in office, but for no other cause. That's what the law says. That's what Congress once again said. The president acting in violation of the law in firing that member of the independent NLRB. Federal prosecutors already made reference to those, summarily firing prosecutors involved in cases against President Trump himself. And of course, the January 6th rioters already pardoned by the president or given commutations. Civil service job protections, as we have long discussed on this broadcast, against arbitrarily and without basis firing federal workers without good cause, without reason, without hearings before something called the Merit Systems Protection Board. That's the mechanism for addressing these kinds of things. The president taking upon himself to do these things unilaterally, firing federal prosecutors, firing also, if not now, certainly in the future, firing probably FBI agents subject to the same kinds of MSPB protections, Merit System Protection Board, those kinds of things going on in violation of the law. You recall well the all of this was started in many ways on his first days by declaring, the president did, that the Constitution's 14th Amendment no longer should be interpreted as granting citizenship to babies who are born on U.S. soil, contrary to the clear language and the interpretation of the 14th Amendment for all of its years ever since it was passed in the wake of the Civil War. Longstanding understanding, the 14th Amendment does in fact grant citizenship to those infants. All of that happening again in the first few weeks of this presidency. Many things all suggesting a president engaging in lawless behavior. When we come back, we'll talk about what we think are the predicates for this. How does Donald Trump get that authority? And it comes from, yes indeed, the Supreme Court. All of that when Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
CBS News Brief. Three more Israeli hostages have been freed by Hamas, the release sparking cheers in Tel Aviv. CBS's Robert Berger is in Jerusalem.
The men, ages 34, 52, and 56, looked thin and pale, but were able to walk on their own power.
In return, 183 Palestinian prisoners have been released by Israel. President Trump is revoking former President Biden's security clearance and ending the daily intelligence briefings he's receiving. CBS's Olivia Rinaldi on why.
He said the reason why he's doing this is because it was done to him.
Flu cases are on the rise in every state right now.
The last time flu levels were this high was in 2009, and the CDC says the cases are still rising.
And CBS's Jennifer Kuiper tells us while the flu season has peaked twice this year, this winter's COVID surge has been relatively mild. CBS News Brief. I'm Stacey Lynn.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
It's Super Bowl Sunday tomorrow. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens reporting from Super Bowl 59 in New Orleans, where the Chiefs and the Eagles will kick off tomorrow night at 5:30. Running back Saquon Barkley had a phenomenal year for the Eagles, rushing for over 2,000 yards, and now is at his first Super Bowl. I asked him, how important is that the Eagles were here just 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think it's important for sure. Having guys like BG, Lane, Jalen, Smitty, all those guys that's played in the game, but I've been playing football since I was 7, 8 years old. You know, obviously it's just on a bigger stage and, you know, it's more eyes, but it's still set hut and you got to go run the ball.
NBA, the Bucks losing last night to the Hawks in Atlanta, 115-110. The Bucks blew a 73-55 lead at the half. Damian Lillard.
We talked about at halftime how we know they, especially at home, they always seem like they come back and get in the games. You know, they play free and we needed to just stay sharp.
That's the Bucks' Damian Lillard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Central Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Additional accumulation of snow today, maybe another 4 or 5 inches. We'll see a high near 24 degrees. For tonight, becoming partly cloudy with a low around 1. For Sunday, sunshine with a high near 16. Monday, mostly sunny, a high near 18.
Right now, it's 19.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A New Hampshire Senate bill just killed in committee would have moved the state's 4 presidential electoral votes to a winner-by-district system from a winner-take-all. Nebraska, the only state besides Maine which apportions its electoral votes by district, is trying to end it. The National Conference of State Legislatures defines a winner-take-all system as one where the winning candidate's party, no matter the margin of victory, gets all of the electoral votes. Currently in Nebraska, which has 5 electoral votes, and Maine, which has 4, 1 electoral vote is awarded for each congressional district a candidate wins, and the candidate who wins the popular vote statewide gets the rest. New Hampshire is currently a winner-take-all state with 2 congressional districts. SB 11 would have adopted the Nebraska and Maine model, likely in anticipation of gerrymandering a guaranteed GOP congressional district. But February 5th, the Senate Election and Municipal Affairs Committee recommended that it be killed in an upcoming full Senate vote. The AP reports that Nebraska's GOP is irritated that candidates Obama, Biden, and Harris won an electoral vote from Greater Omaha's Congressional District 2. Another legislative attempt to end it appears doomed to fail by filibuster, so state Republicans are preparing a ballot measure instead, hoping the voters will change what the legislature could not. We have links to the local reporting and more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Maggie Dawn.
Do you know that Donald Trump's draconian policies are hurting children right here in Wisconsin? Dane County's Head Start program experiences outages. We discuss at 3 o'clock.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, joined in the studio here in Radio Park by my wonderful producer, Max. And together we're taking your phone calls at 855-752-4842. You can also be in touch with us by dropping a note, a comment, an observation, a question in the drop box, Civic Media. And we are talking this weekend in our broadcast all about the rule of law, checks and balances. In our first segments, identifying a laundry list, very summarily, not a lot of detail there, believe it or not, about 10 or 12 different ways in which the current president, Donald Trump, is running afoul of established, not just principles and mores and ways of doing things, the models of our nation, but also running afoul, arguably, as federal district court judges are telling us, of the Constitution and the laws of our land. Many, many different ways, domestically, foreign actions, and a lot of the responses by federal judges happening almost in real time as parties who are aggrieved by the things that the president is doing run into federal court and say, this is in violation of the law. Do something to stop it. And federal judges have been responding almost unanimously in various areas. We're going to be focusing upon at least four of those in this broadcast, ways in which the federal district judges have entered what are called temporary restraining orders. That is, temporarily preventing Donald Trump, temporarily preventing the administration from going ahead to pursue these various things, including everything from birthright citizenship revocation to NLRB appointments to prosecutors to foreign aid and domestic aid freezes, all kinds of things. Again, those TROs do not stay in place indefinitely. They're subject to follow-up hearings. And indeed, there's been at least one of those when it comes to that birthright citizenship issue that we'll talk about this weekend as well. Federal judges, among the guardrails, the standards, the ways in which checks and balances still work in America, even if the executive branch engaging in violative conduct, even if we have yet to see whether U.S. attorneys out there will also enforce or not enforce the laws of our land. Not a lot of visibility yet on whether grand juries are preventing investigations of people inappropriately pursued already, arguably, by this administration. And that will also lead to the other subject we'll talk about later in our broadcast. That is our new attorney general and the many things that she is already doing, creating and stopping various task forces, creating various mechanisms, new policies with respect to national security and our environment, all kinds of things going on, as she said, as the Department of Justice serves Donald Trump. Keep that in mind. I'll contrast that to what my boss, Eric Holder, and my ultimate boss, the former president of the United States of America, said to U.S. attorneys back in his administration. That administration, of course, Barack Obama, telling us that we don't serve him. We don't even serve the government. We serve the people of the United States of America. Contrast that to what our incoming new attorney general has already said about the ways in which fealty and allegiance to Donald Trump is all what the Department of Justice is about. Let's get back, however, to the predicates for where this is coming from. Where does Donald Trump receive the authority to do this? Well, in part, he says it's political. In part, he continues to make reference to the fact that he was given, as he says, a mandate by the American population way back in early November. And based upon that mandate, he is doing the things that he's doing. That's what he's telling us right now. The people of America told me to do these things, and that's what I'm doing. I'm making good on campaign promises. Question whether or not many of these things, including, for instance, the USAID issue, which is looming large right now, whether that was a part of the campaign at all or that was an add-on. He did begin to talk about it in December of last year. But putting aside the timing of all of this and the focus of all of this and the breakneck speed with which all of these executive orders and directives to hire and fire and to impose various restrictions with respect to money and policy and practice, putting aside the speed and the inaccuracy and the failure of this to be supported by law, the question is, where does Donald Trump get the authority to do this? And I would offer, as I have before, that we can look again down Pennsylvania Avenue, beyond the parking lot there on Capitol Hill, beyond the parking lot of our Capitol building. Go across the street there to First Street, First Capitol, and look at the United States Supreme Court and what they did and what the Chief Justice did on July 1 of last year. We've talked a lot about this on this broadcast. I would offer to you that the specters that we posed back then, the ghosts, the concerns about the implications of this major case, Trump versus United States, had not yet been seen under the Biden administration, because you had a president until January 20th who was not invoking these amazing powers given to a president by the Supreme Court. And this president plainly doing just that in ways that we have seen, probably many ways in which we have not yet seen. What did the Supreme Court do again way back in July? Seems like a long period of time ago. It's not. The language of what I'm about to recite for you remains the law of this land. This is Trump versus United States, July 1, 2024. A majority of the Supreme Court, admittedly just six members, written by the Chief Justice, scathing dissents by three other members of the Supreme Court, as you know well, Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor. Fearing for the future of the democracy, fearing for the future of the republic, they wrote, and dissenting not with respect to what the Supreme Court had done. The Supreme Court, in addition to establishing for the first time in our history the notion that a president is indeed above the law, and that concept in itself probably given Donald Trump an awful lot of support and reason to do what he is doing. Those immunities, both presumptive immunities, going into the notion that we're going to presume that a president is immune for virtually anything that he or she may do. Absolute immunities when it comes to the Department of Justice. Again, a focus of a lot of this coming out of his White House in recent days. And again, the Bondi administration, the Bondi Department of Justice itself. But beyond the specifics of that major, horrific, catastrophic decision coming from our Supreme Court and the pen of our Chief Justice, John Roberts, back in July, are the first pages of that order. They're somewhat overlooked when we think about the overall impact of that order saying, yes, Mr. President, you're immune from prosecution. Because as an antecedent to that, as a predicate for coming to that conclusion, the Supreme Court went back and revisited the notion of executive authority, lots and lots of pages before then, and cobbled together based upon some very, very random. And yes, they exist, but not in the way that the Supreme Court put them together. All sorts of little bits and pieces to establish an all-powerful executive branch of the sort that we have not seen before. Let's hear what the Supreme Court told Joe Biden. Let's hear what the Supreme Court has told Donald Trump and is telling presidents in the future. Until this law, until this decision is somehow rescinded or put on the dung heap where it should be, of Supreme Court decisions. Here's what the Supreme Court is telling our current president. Said this: the president occupies a unique position in the constitutional scheme. Well, let's stop right there. One of three branches, and yes, unique in terms of the executive authorities, but not unique in terms of sharing responsibility with other authorities. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court is saying the president occupies a unique position in the constitutional scheme as the only person who alone composes a branch of government. Now, that's certainly technically true. It is physically true. Is that a basis then for vesting in that singular person all of the authorities that are to come? Offer that just the opposite would be true, because there's no check and balance. You don't have 435 members of the House of Representatives who check each other. You don't have 100 members of the United States Senate. You don't even have 9 members of a Supreme Court. You've got one person alone. Supreme Court says that's the basis for giving that person a huge amount of power. There's even more. The framers, John Roberts tells us, sought to encourage energetic, vigorous, decisive, and speedy execution of the laws by placing in the hands of a single, constitutionally indispensable individual the ultimate authority that, in respect to the other branches, the Constitution divides among many. Oh my goodness, Let's read that again. Let's take that in one more time, because that's the language. That's the language that is giving Donald Trump his, from his view, his authority to go ahead and do these things, yes, as quickly as he's doing this, these things, but also with the power that he's doing it. Supreme Court told him that the framers of our Constitution envisioned that our president would be energetic, vigorous, decisive, and speedy in the execution of laws by placing in his singular hands constitutionally indispensable individual rights, the ultimate authority to do these things that in other branches is divided among other people. That language should also make the hair on the back of your necks stand up. The Supreme Court goes on, says the framers also deemed an energetic executive essential to the protection of the community against foreign attacks, the steady administration of the laws, the protection of property, and the security of liberty. Now, lots of that you can't object to. A lot of that's in the Constitution. We envision that. But in the wake of that notion that all of those powers are to be executed with the energy and vigor and decisiveness and speed and muscularity that the Supreme Court envisions, that's what we're seeing now. This is the Supreme Court's language coming true. The purpose, John Roberts went on to say, of a vigorous and energetic executive is to ensure good government. For a feeble executive implies a feeble execution of the government. You have to have vigor. You have to have energy, John Roberts tells us, because if you go in the opposite direction, you get bad government. And a bad government implies feeble government, and we can't have that, he said. Went on to say, the framers accordingly vested with the president a supervisory and policy responsibilities of the utmost discretion and sensitivity, has to make the most sensitive and far-reaching decisions entrusted to any official under our constitutional system. There accordingly, John Roberts went on to say, exists the greatest public interest in providing the president with the duties of his office. Appreciating again, this is John Roberts in Trump versus United States, July 1, 2024, appreciating the unique risks to the effective functioning of government that arise when the president's energies are diverted. Unless they can be completely focused on these things, don't divert the president, because if you divert the president by proceedings that might render him unduly cautious in the discharge of his official duties, we have recognized presidential immunities and privileges rooted in our constitutional tradition of the separation of powers and supported by our history. That's a lot of language there. All of that saying that indeed, because there's a risk. There's a risk of feeble government. There's a risk that a president might be diverted by things like, oh, say, checks and balances, by people saying, Mr. President, you can't do that. Mr. President, you're not above the law. We can't have that, John Roberts is saying. And because of that, that diversionary possibility, we have to have this energetic, vigorous, decisive, speedy, muscular executive that we have not seen. We have not seen until this presidency and the last 20 days. We're reminded here on this broadcast of the commission, the responsibility that the United States Supreme Court holds as well, sending this instruction. And let's be clear, this is the law of the land in America. This is not some random musing by John Roberts and five other colleagues, admittedly with scathing, horrific dissents by other members of the Supreme Court, horrific only in the sense of horrified by what the majority has said and done. This is not some random musing. This is not a law review article. This is not a piece appearing in a law review in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, in any other newspaper. This is not something that's posted on social media. This is the law of the land, and we follow it. And indeed, I would offer here, as we begin to think about what Donald Trump is doing under the rule of law and whether there are still guardrails, this is the commission by the United States Supreme Court, your court given to Donald Trump. And we continue, we'll talk about some of those guardrails coming in from federal judges and the possibility that much of this may get back to that same Supreme Court at some point in the future of our nation, right here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio WXCO, home of the big high school sports show.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Donald Trump is president again, and Democrats need to take a new approach to combat this presidency. Part of that is recognizing the realignment of how we arrived here. In last year's election, one thing Trump did successfully was turn out people who might not otherwise vote. In Wisconsin, he increased his vote share in all 72 counties en route to the largest popular vote total in state history. How did he do this? Well, as I see it, there are two factions of Republicans. One is the more traditional country club Republicans. The other is the newer group, what I'm calling the pro-wrestling Republicans. In my latest column, I wrote about how Donald Trump transformed the party by prioritizing the pro-wrestling Republicans, and why recognizing this new reality is critical to Democrats' ability to grab a steel chair of their own and fight back. Subscribe and read it now at the Recombobulation Area.
Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
This is Amicus Solar Review. My name is Jim Santel. We're spending a lot of time necessarily talking this weekend about Donald Trump and his decisions in many, many areas of government operation, both domestically and overseas, issuing executive orders, telling people inside the administration what the Trump administration now demands of them, even as members of his cabinet fall into place, including our recently invested Attorney General Pam Bondi. We're going to be spending some time in our next hour talking about the continuing work that she has done, continuing the work of a fellow named Emile Beauvais, who's been acting as the acting Deputy Attorney General. We'll talk about what Pam Bondi has done just in this past week to further implement the plans and policies, the law enforcement, the rule of law policies of this president that also include all of these other things which we've already taken very, very broad and superficial inventory of in the areas of, yes, social media and TikTok and inspectors general, the National Labor Relations Board, federal prosecutors, birthright citizenship, all kinds of things, USAID, grant freezes domestically, foreign, all kinds of things out there that almost defy listings because they're changing all the time. And more of them happening again at breakneck speed gets us back to what the Supreme Court has said, which is that we anticipate, according to the Supreme Court, that an executive, a president, should act with that breakneck speed, energetic, quickly, nimble, muscular, doing all those kinds of things with vigor and decisive action. We're getting that. We're getting that, Mr. Chief Justice. And you commissioned the president to do just this. However, we also have a system of laws in America, and many of the individuals, many of the groups out there who have felt aggrieved by these various actions of the president and his administration in all of these areas have gone into federal court. And what do? You go in and you file, yes, that's right, a lawsuit. You file a civil complaint. All of these are civil in nature. None of them is criminal because only, of course, United States attorneys and only grand juries can issue grand jury indictments, of course, coming out of the federal system. But citizens, all of us, groups, individuals can run into the federal district courts, the 93 of them nationwide and in our territories, run to the district courts and go into the clerk of court's office and say, I'm filing this complaint. That's the legal name for the document that initiates a civil action. And in those civil complaints, outlining exactly what the president has done in a particular area, identifying the nature of the executive order or the directive coming out of the White House, and identifying then the ways in which, according to the petitioner, the plaintiff in that civil case, the defendant, the whether it could be a particular agency, more often it is actually Donald J. Trump in his official capacity, sometimes other members of his cabinet, the defendants in those cases identifying the ways in which they are running afoul of the laws. That's all put forth in a document. That's called the complaint. And accompanying those complaints are also what are called petitions for emergency relief, asking the judges to whom those cases are randomly assigned in various districts around the nation, please act quickly. Why? Because if you don't, bad things will happen. You need to preserve the status quo until we can get in front of you in a full trial, a full days-long, certainly hours-long at a minimum proceeding, to explain to you why it is that what the president has done is in violation of the law, violation of the Constitution. So right now, judge, that's the request that goes along with the complaint. Please stop this from happening. Direct the White House. In your role as a federal judge, checks and balances, the kinds of things that we do understand of the Constitution, under Article 3 of the Constitution, you have got that right to check another branch. You've got the right, as one of our first chief justices said, to decide what the law is and tell us what the law is, and to decide on the legitimacy of actions by an executive branch. That's what goes on when the petitioners go into federal district courts and ask for immediate relief. And that's what we've seen in recent days in virtually all of these areas, in the area of birthright citizenship, in this area of shutting down the USAID, in the area of this incentive program for getting rid of government employees, telling them to resign now. We'll continue to pay you through September, but leave now. And yes, indeed, as late as when we're coming on the air here this weekend, another judge telling Elon Musk that indeed he has to keep his hands off all of that Treasury information that relates to the ways in which the Treasury Department intersects with millions, hundreds of millions of Americans on a regular basis. A federal judge now temporarily stopping that. Of course, the important notion there, temporarily doing this until such time as the parties can come in and argue these cases at greater length, identifying exactly what's happened, the impact of these cases upon those particular plaintiffs, the groups that they represent, the individuals serving as plaintiffs. That's the process that's right now going ahead in many ways, big and small. And yes, it is indeed difficult to keep track of all of it. We're going to identify again just four of those, I mentioned them already, in which federal judges, once again, in America, doing their duties under Article 3 of the Constitution to provide some check and some balance. Now, again, as I invoke the Supreme Court and its rule, what can happen? Well, these judges can indeed, they can do what's called vacate a temporary restraining order. They can decide not to issue an injunction of a permanent or even preliminary nature. They can say, you know what, my initial stay of all this action that was improvidently granted, I'm going to let the government go ahead and do just this. Highly unlikely that that will happen, given some of the things that the judges have already said when it comes to access to these Treasury information blocks, these incentive programs, the USAID issue, birthright citizenship. An awful lot of those judges already saying, you must be kidding. Where are the lawyers? This is so overtly contrary to the law that everybody should know that this does need to be restrained, does need to be stopped. But there's a chance that when these cases go ahead, the judges can do more to rescind, to refine their orders that they're already entering. Of course, all of these orders are then subject to appeal to the various circuit courts. We've talked a lot about those here on this broadcast. You go up to the Fourth Circuit, you go up to the D.C. Circuit, to the Ninth Circuit, to the 11th Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and say, you know what, that lower court judge, he got it wrong, she got it wrong. And you get before a panel of judges and you argue the case there that the lower court decision was wrong or right if you are the successful litigant at the lower court level. And yes, indeed, all of this underscores the prospect that all of this work right now being done at district courts could ultimately see the light of day where? Back at the United States Supreme Court. United States Supreme Court that, again, has given an awful lot of authority to our president in this major decision. As Amicus Law Review continues, we're going to talk about specifically what's happened in those four major cases. Lots and lots of litigation out there. Federal District Court judges, I would offer the heroes of this weekend broadcast who are providing the guardrails against unconstitutional behavior. Stay with us for all that discussion.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, Wausau's home for Matt Nair on Air.
Jane Matt Nair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Mr. Global Matt Randolph is back to talk about the Trump administration policies and how that's affecting us, heating our houses and filling up the gas. Join us.
Matt Nair on Air, weekday mornings at 10.
No more mold. No more damage. No more slipping and hurting. Make your ordinary bathroom extraordinary for only $99 per month. New shower, new door, new tub, new wall, new anti-slip technology. BCI Bath and Shower is made in America for the highest quality. First 50 callers save $1,500 on a Never-Clear glass treated door. BCI Bath and Shower. Interest-free financing options. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. Crowds gathered in Tel Aviv to celebrate the release of more hostages. Here's CBS's Robert Berger.
Three male Israeli hostages were released by Hamas after 491 days in captivity in Gaza. The deal went through despite Arab anger over President Trump's proposal to transfer the Palestinian population out of Gaza. It's the fifth hostage release since the ceasefire began 3 weeks ago. 21 hostages have been released so far.
Now, the hostages are being taken to a hospital to be checked out. The BBC's Joe Inwood tells us the same with some of the 183 Palestinian prisoners freed from Israel.
A number of those Palestinians had to be taken to hospital, the Palestinian Prisoners Association say, because their condition